Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman. Welcome back to Vashon 250 for episode number 26, The Battles of Saratoga. This is episode 26, and we, as we've discussed in previous episodes, it would be easy to spend a great deal of time dwelling on the details of the bloody battlefield. While interesting and worthy of reflection, there are other arguably more important elements of these events that we want to focus on. In the case of Saratoga, it served as a motivating factor for the creation of our alliance with France that holds great significance. With that in mind, let's look at the battles of Saratoga. They consisted of two significant engagements. The first battle, also known as the Battle of Freeman's Farm on September 19, 1777, and the second Battle of Saratoga, or the Battle of Bemis Heights on October 7, 1777, about 3 weeks apart. These battles were fought between the American Continental Army, commanded by Generals Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold, and the British Army, led by General John Burgoyne near Saratoga, New York. In the first battle, Burgoyne's forces engaged the Americans at Freeman's Farm. Although Burgoyne achieved a tactical victory, he suffered heavy casualties, which weakened his army significantly. The second battle, again about 3 weeks later, the Americans launched a counterattack, leading to a decisive victory. Burgoyne's forces were surrounded and ultimately forced to surrender on October 17. The American victory at Saratoga is often regarded as a turning point in the Revolutionary War. It not only boosted American morale, but also demonstrated to foreign powers, particularly France, that the American forces could defeat the British Army. The outcome of the battles convinced France to enter the war as an ally of the Americans, providing crucial military support and resources that would be instrumental in the eventual American victory. The battles also thwarted British plans to divide the colonies by controlling the Hudson River Valley, which was a key strategic objective for the British forces. As an aside, you might want to find a map someplace of upstate New York to see how the Hudson Valley operates and what that all means. So, we have our good friend Nancy Bristow back with us today. Nancy, you want to respond to that introduction about the two battles?
Well, I think it's really interesting as we begin to think about American history and this revolution, this idea that there are moments that matter. And you don't necessarily know just how significant they are as they happen. But as you look back, you go, ah, that was a turning point. That was a moment that really mattered as you feel the shift of gravity at that moment.
And if I can jump in, I mean, they're not only turning points, if you look at them, but they are also significant shifts in political attitudes or a political direction. And Saratoga is both of those. I mean, militarily, it's a turning point. You know, France realizes America can actually beat the Brits, and so why not jump on and become part of that? But it also destroys the British strategy of splitting the northern and the southern colonies apart. So Britain has to sort of retreat, if you will, and rethink how they're going to fight this war. And that, to me, is the significance of something like Saratoga. It's a turning point, but it also forces a shift in political strategy or political thought. And together, that makes Saratoga an important battle. I mean, as you mentioned, we don't really focus on many of the battles in this sort of series because we're really looking at sort of the impact of a revolution, the ideas, you know, the social sort of consequences of the American Revolution. The battles are important, but they're also they can become the focus, and you lose sight of what the revolution was really about. And I think so many historians get caught up in the excitement of telling the stories of battles. And battles are important, but they're not what the war is about. But Saratoga is one of those battles where it's not worth focusing on the battle itself, because the battle, the battle lines, the sort of the strategic and tactical decisions, are the same in any battle, and somebody wins and somebody loses. But the consequences are what really are important here. And Saratoga is that turning point and forces a shift in the whole British approach to the Revolutionary War.
And I guess I would add, not to go down the battlefield road too far, the British were supposed to have support coming down from Ontario. That didn't show up. They were supposed to have some support come up from New York. That didn't show up until too late. And that came in the second battle. In the interim, there were militias that the colonists had that did show up. And so we got to rearm ourselves. And so there was strategy, like playing the game Stratego or Battleship or whatever. Sure. They were able to lay it out. So, there was some skill at this. Yeah. But also it was a true turning point. So if we look at over the last 250 years since then, what are the events that, I guess, echo the significance of Saratoga as a turning point and as a strategic political shift? And I'll throw that out to both of you.
Right, yeah. Certainly elections, when elections represent big changes in sort of political direction, become part of that. And one, of course, is the 1800 election of Thomas Jefferson. The first time really that political power shifts in the United States. I mean, you had Washington, you had Adams, but they were basically, the same party, the same sort of attitudes, the same political philosophy. Jefferson brings in a very different political philosophy and wins the election, and it's a peaceful transfer of power. And that begins to establish a precedent for future American elections that has held for almost 250 years. And so that's a big piece of it. Another significant election is the election of Jackson, in 1828. Here you have this wild Westerner. I mean, we don't think of Tennessee as the West, but in 1828, it's the wild frontier. And here you have this relatively uneducated, wild sort of guy who has no social skills in terms of what Washington, D.C. and New England and the South thought of as social skills. And he wins an election. And I mean, the party in power, John Quincy Adams thinks it's going to be the end of the world. But it's not. It's not that it's not a significant shift. I mean, Jackson's policies toward Native people, Jackson's policies toward Western expansion, big changes. But at the same time, the Union moves forward, if you will.
And it moves forward, of course, until that consequential election of 1860. So again and again and again, we see elections being sometimes those turning points, because they are a moment when the nation decides, makes a choice about direction.
Right.
Usually the nation decides to move along with the winners of that election. But of course, in 1860, that doesn't happen.
Right.
But the election of Abraham Lincoln, representing the idea that enslavement could not expand into those new territories and states, the South secedes from the nation, right? And the Civil War will determine that you can't do that, that we have a nation in perpetuity. But if there's an election that had consequences, that was a true turning point, because as you think about what it leads to the Civil War. You can talk about the consequences of the Civil War for the country in all kinds of ways. It's not just that there's a war that happens, but it leads to the emancipation of 4 million people. It leads to the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. Perhaps most importantly, the 14th Amendment, which brings us birthright citizenship, and also brings us due process of law and the equal protection of the law, which applies to all of us who are U.S. citizens. The 15th Amendment, which opens up the electorate beyond that expansion that we saw with white male voters in under Jacksonian democracy. We see the expansion then into the African-American community as well. So again, elections have been so consequential. For example, one that I can't skip over is the sort of irony around the election of Teddy Roosevelt. He wasn't elected actually to be president. He was elected to be vice president, but with the assassination of McKinley in 1901, he becomes the first president that we think of as a president of the progressive era that leads to all kinds of transformations in American life, including workman's compensation or the Food and Drug Administration. Another one that you can't skip over, of course, is the election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. This is a huge change, building on what had happened in the progressive era, the determination that the federal government really will have a responsibility for the citizens, including economic sort of well-being of the country as a whole. And that, again, builds that New Deal world that we lived with until pretty recently as an uncontested sort of circumstance for the country. Of course, that contest, another election you can't skip over, is the election then of Ronald Reagan in 1980. The determination that maybe some of that safety net is inappropriate and having a majority of Americans moving that direction. And the Reagan election, of course, is only the first step in what will be a series of transformations that take us right up to the present.
And it's hard to believe that that's 40 years ago. So let's look at more modern times, Bruce, at some of the changes we've seen.
Sure. Just in the last decade. I mean, you've got 2020, the Supreme Court Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage. I mean, that's a huge change for thousands, millions of Americans potentially. You know, the 2016 and 2024 elections of Trump, those are big shifts in sort of American political thought. 2022, the overturning of Roe versus Wade. 2024. Trump versus the U.S., the president has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts, within the president's exclusive core of constitutional authority. And then, June of 2026, the massive expansion of the president's power to fire heads of agencies, in the last decade, we've seen major shifts taking place in American political thought and American political power. It was in the 1960s and 70s you first began to hear the term the imperial presidency, sort of the emergence of that sort of strong presidential power that begins to emerge after World War II. Well, we're seeing that, in spades right now. I mean, it is really developing into an area where many people are concerned that the presidency and the office of the presidency is moving toward an autocracy in the United States. And then also in American wars, there have been other battles that sort of reflect that same sort of turning point. You think of Gettysburg and the Civil War. I mean, the South has victory after victory after victory. And finally, the industrial might of the North finally coalesces enough at Gettysburg to sort of stop that string of Confederate victories. And from that point on, the war is virtually over. I mean, it goes on for a couple of years, but in effect, it's a retreat by the South back into its own territory and a collapse and ultimately surrender. You look at World War II and D-Day, just how significant that was in bringing the war to the German homeland. The invasion of France, sort of the breaking, of the Iron Wall around Europe was a tremendously significant turning point. In the Pacific, the move through the islands, the capture of Iwo Jima, because that allowed long-range American bombers to reach, the Japanese homeland. Huge sort of turning points. And then the Korean War, sort of the forgotten war. Nobody thinks about it much, but the Korean War begins with North Korea invading over the 38th parallel, sort of the neutralized zone, if you will. You know, the Americans come in with the South Koreans and push them right back up to the Chinese border. The Chinese come in, push us down to the Busan perimeter, which is one tiny little corner of the very bottom of the Korean Peninsula. And then MacArthur has the brilliant military move of the Incheon Landing, sort of flanks the Chinese North Korean army, rolls them back to the 38th parallel. And it's still, the Korean War has never ended. There's never been there's an armistice, but there's never been a peace treaty. So, American wars, you have these big, significant turning points. So battles can be important.
Yeah. And the wars can be important for the consequences that follow them, as we were just talking about with the Civil War. Another thing that I've already mentioned, constitutional amendments or decisions by the Supreme Court would be another example. One caution I want to put before us is some of the, quote, turning points. I would turn immediately to the Brown decision in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, that makes segregation in education, public education, illegal. And of course, that's read then to have much larger consequences across American life. But what the Brown decision doesn't come out of nowhere, right? The Brown decision is the result of the NAACP, which is the result of the organizing within the Black community and the assertion of first just creating an organization to defend rights and then having a legal arm that pursues case after case after case that gets us to the Brown decision. And the decision that the court makes took many years, right? It's a couple of years after the hearing of the cases that the court decides. And that has to do with an effort to cultivate support for that direction in the country. So as we have these massive, really important decisions made by the Supreme Court, for instance, those are often the result of a much broader sort of participation of American citizens in calling for the kinds of rights, again, going back and connecting up to that revolutionary generation where, wait a minute, we have a set of values, we have a set of rights that we should fight for. And so some of the turning points that we associate as sort of institutional changes have their roots in the movement by American citizens.
Oh, they do, and in both directions, both in sort of expanding rights and in constricting rights. I mean, you know, the model that Brown set up with the NAACP is just bringing all these cases in local courts and then in district courts and then in, and bringing them up to the Supreme Court in a process. You know, over what, a 60, 70 year period after Plessy versus Ferguson ultimately overturns Plessy versus Ferguson. But you look at what's happened with Roe versus Wade. You know, you look at what's happened with same-sex marriage. You looked at what's happening with trans rights, just recently decided by the Supreme Court. It's not just expansion of rights, but also constriction of rights. All use that same sort of legal process. And it's fascinating to see that. And for most of us who grew up in the post-World War II period, we've seen that sort of sweep toward liberal expansion of rights. But in the 21st century, we've seen that same process work to constrict rights.
So let's bring it home here to the center of Puget Sound. What are some Vashon events that echo the victory at Saratoga that marked a turning point, acknowledging that we don't have battles on Vashon, at least armed ones?
Well, we don't.
Pitchforks and shovels, right.
I mean, the great sort of example in my mind is the whole set of ferry battles that begin with the Mosquito Fleet, but really intensify in the 1930s. As the Black Ball Fleet establishes a monopoly in Puget Sound. And it's also the time of strikes as labor unions and particularly the Inland Boatmen's Union and the Captains and Mates Union are fighting for better pay and better hours and better working conditions. And what it does, it sets up throughout Puget Sound, you know, a whole sort of movement by the public to ask for the state to take over the ferry service. And of course, that's prohibited by the Washington State Constitution initially, and it takes several actions by the legislature to finally, by the 1940s, late 1940s, to get that changed. But what you have is a struggle through the 1930s with ferry service and disruptions. And then World War II comes along, and there's a memorandum of agreement to not change fares, to not have strikes. And so all through World War II, ferry service just hums along, you know, with no problems. As soon as the war's over, you know, Blackball wants to put rates up. You know, the unions want to get pay increases. And bam, you know, 46, 47, you have massive strikes that lead Vashon to say, we're done with it. We're going to form our own ferry district. And they form their own ferry district, which has its own set of problems.
Yeah.
But you know, from 1947 into the early 50s, Vashon runs its own ferry service and provides a model for the state to create the legal ability of the state to buy the Blackball system, which it does in 1951. And when they buy the Blackball system, Vashon turns its ferries over to the new state, Washington State Ferry System, and goes out of business. But that's that sort of similar thing when you think about Saratoga. You know, that wasn't just one struggle. I mean, it was one battle, if you will, to sort of keep the Vashon Ferry District alive. You know, sort of the Battle of the North End Dock, if you will, when the Blackball fleet attempted to come back in, and the ferry district attorney said, if you let the Elwha land at Vashon North End Dock, then they'll have the right to come back anytime they want. So that leads to the great vigilantes, Vashon vigilantes, showing up at the dock with, you know, axe handles and pitchforks and whatever, and keeping the ferry from landing. I think the Blackball fleet had enough sense to just say, hey, we're not going to fight that battle. And so they let Vashon run its own ferry system. But had that ferry landed, you know, Vashon ferry system would have been in competition with the Blackball ferry system and, you know, probably couldn't have survived. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we don't have pitched battles on Vashon Island, but we do have conflicts, and that's just one great example.
But then if we jump ahead to the pandemic, as one of these examples with COVID, and Vashon Be Prepared and its response, that was a citizen-led decisive victory of organized response.
Yeah.
That's pretty darned impressive when you look at it.
It's remarkable, really, and it took so many people. The number of citizens on this rock that stepped up to fill roles, whether it was delivering food to families. Obviously, we have the large effort first for testing and then for vaccination that was really important. Alongside that, right, all of these organizations that already existed, like Vashon Be Prepared and the MRC, they step up to do remarkable organizational work that leads our island to have a stunningly low rate of both infection and hospitalization and death. I mean, compared to anyone. Mm-hmm. This is well established. The data is there and has been published, I think.
Yeah.
So that on the most basic, you know, battle against a disease, we were incredibly successful. And that happened because of citizens of Vashon stepping up to lead that charge and to make really smart, organized, collaborative efforts to find what the best responses were, to look at the public health literature, to talk with other people, and to make decisions that were good for the island. And that's an extraordinary accomplishment.
Yeah, it is. And yet it didn't happen in a vacuum. That's what's important to understand about it. I mean, the EOC, you know, Vashon Be Prepared, had started being prepared for the big earthquake, you know, almost 20 years earlier.
That's right.
You know, in the early 2000s, they start to organize. You know, General Joe Ulatowski sort of saying, hey, you need to have an emergency sort of a plan here. And so you have things in place beginning to consider the idea of what are we going to do if there's a big earthquake, which was the major sort of concern of a disaster on Bashan Island. And so you have the Medical Reserve Corps, which has, you know, 10, 15 members. You know, you have Bashan Be Prepared, which is, you know, 15, 20 people. You have all of these things in place. But when the pandemic comes along, I mean, the Emergency Medical Reserve Corps goes from 15 members to 120 members in a month.
You had no excuse to not be vaccinated.
You know, I'd like to throw something in here as your engineer.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I'm discovering is that you need leadership to do that. But for it to really happen, you need to have the people volunteer to come forward to make this event happen. And that takes more than just leadership. That takes a lot of self-initiative to get folks to do this. Personally, I'm working on a project that's lacking that kind of input. Mm-hmm. And it makes a huge difference.
Yep. So
I just wanted to throw that out. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Well, and that's good, because I look back at my upbringing in the city of Destiny, Tacoma, and my parents were active volunteers in a whole host of things. And I think my wife and I try and carry on that same sort of tradition, but I do worry about whether our younger generation is plugged in that same way. It's not that they don't do it, but when I look at most of our charitable boards on the island and in the big cities too, they tend to be older people. And ultimately, us older people wear out, and so we need to backfill. That's an issue of concern. That's a little off topic, but it is an issue of concern.
It's not a concern to me, and let me tell you why.
Okay.
All you have to do is go to the little kids' baseball games, the little kids' soccer games.
Right.
You have to go to the co-op preschool. You have to go to the places where those young parents, those 20, 30, 40-year-olds, are putting in all the volunteer time to make it happen. But it's centered around their families. It's centered around their kids. It's centered around their interest. Voice of Bashan, they don't care so much about Voice of Bashan. The Heritage Museum, the Land Trust, they get more involved with because they take their kids out on the trail. But it's the nature of nonprofits, I think, to depend on an older generation to provide the boards and the leadership. But all you have to do is look outside.
Follow
the kids.
Well, I think that's right, because that middle generation, I live with a couple of folks from that generation, and they're very actively involved on island. Some of that is through their work. Right. Some of it is through, you know, things that are supporting their own children. But they are very tapped into the island, but not necessarily in those quote leadership roles, but in filling out, you know, and in some cases they are actually in leadership roles as well. But again, they may be more closely linked to things connected to family, but they're ready, they're primed, they're interested, they're connected, and they're really good at what they do.
And they're working full time.
And raising children, some of them.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. Yeah. I stand corrected where needed. So with that, let's close up here, and I'll leave you with an aside. The USS Saratoga, a warship built for the War of 1812, was named for the battles of Saratoga. In 1841, a major channel in our own Puget Sound, adjacent to Whidbey Island and Camano Island, was named Saratoga Passage in honor of the ship. So if you're heading north to the San Juans, British Columbia, or Alaska, you may traverse Saratoga Passage. At the very least, stop to do some crabbing or fishing, because it's usually pretty good there. Next time, we take on the Redcoats as they take on Philadelphia. And we'll see you then. And that concludes this week's episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Bashan Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Bashan website at voiceofbashan.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon250 is a presentation of Voice of Bashan, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.